It's another beautiful day in sunny California, and these long musical intros always make me hungry. So I decided to stop for a bite at a restaurant called the California Pizza Kitchen. And since you're joining me for lunch, I wanted to recommend this dish to you if you're ever in town, but it seems that the waitress brought me something other than what I ordered, so I don't know what it's called, unfortunately. But everything turned out okay, as it was really delicious, with potatoes, mushrooms, onions, and a really tender marinated steak in what tasted like a wine sauce that had a Japanese flavor to it. That said, I expect there will be some comments concerned about my eating meat and espousing the virtues of veganism, promoting the new alternative artificial lab-grown meat instead. And while I totally support the vegetarian lifestyle in theory, as I'm an animal lover and I'm against any animal cruelty, especially in the food industry, there are certain useful esoteric benefits to a moderate amount of meat in the diet for spiritual practices, including tantra and sacred types of qigong and advanced yogic practices. I also anticipate comments reminding me that most gurus in India are against eating beef, where cows are seen as sacred and their slaughter is largely forbidden. And again, I totally support the concept on ethical grounds. I just don't agree with many of the alleged modern gurus in India, who I admire for keeping many of the ancient Aryan traditions alive, but are themselves several thousand years removed from the time of the ancient Aryans where their teachings come from, and much of the occult knowledge of antiquity has been misunderstood, confused, and in many cases altered completely. Much of what is going on in India today has to do with the struggle between Hindu nationalism and Muslims, and this political and cultural dispute manifests itself in the diet industry. And my point is strictly in the context of esoteric practices, which involves the harnessing and transmuting of what is known in India as prana, in Asia as chi or ki, and in some European occult circles as vril, a type of life force energy. Scholars have known for centuries that the ancient Indians ate beef. It was after the 4th century BC that the practice of vegetarianism spread throughout India among Buddhists, Jains, and Hindus. But in the time of the oldest Hindu sacred text, the Rig Veda, from around 1500 BC, cow meat was consumed. The Vedic Aryans in India generally ate the castrated steers, but they would eat the female cows during rituals or when welcoming a guest, for example, or a person of high status. Ancient ritual texts known as Brahmanas, dating to around 900 BC, and other texts that taught that the bull or cow should be killed to be eaten when a guest arrives. According to these texts, quote, the cow is food. The Sanskrit epic, the Mahabharata, explains the transition to the non-eating of cows in a famous myth. Quote, once, when there was a great famine, King Prithu took up his bow and arrow and pursued the earth to force her to yield nourishment for his people. The earth assumed the form of a cow and begged him to spare her life. She then allowed him to milk her for all that the people needed. This myth imagines a transition from hunting wild cattle to preserving their lives, domesticating them, and breeding them for milk. A transition to agriculture and pastoral life. It visualizes the cow as an animal that yields food without being killed. Between 300 BC and 300 AD, there are some texts that say cows should not be eaten, and the Hindus that did eat meat started to make an exception with the cow. Sometimes this had to do with status and the caste system, and religious sanctions were used. but this should not be confused with the ancient spiritual practices of which I'm intimately familiar with and is the only point I'm trying to make here. In India, cows became a sort of currency among the Brahmins, a higher caste, and they would sometimes be paid in cows, and it became a way for the lower caste to move up the social ladder by giving up beef. And by the 19th century, Gandhi pushed for veganism, especially in regards to beef, and used the image of the earth cow to symbolize Mother Earth and the Indian nation. But modern Hindu nationalism, while a positive force in regards to combating Chinese communism, for example, should not be confused with ancient Aryan spiritual practices, which did not originate in India, nor did the original Aryan philosophies which led to Buddhism, which can all be traced back to civilizations around the steppes, such as those today regarded as Scythians. It was these grasslands where the horse and cattle were domesticated and introduced into India, which were not native to the subcontinent, but introduced by these ancient Aryans, who also introduced Sanskrit itself into India. So while I have a lot of respect for vegetarians, because many of them are compassionate people, and they extend their altruism and kindness to the animal kingdom, so I value their perspective a lot, I just want to make this point today, because I'll be releasing some instructional videos soon on actual techniques, including diet. And in a practical sense, being vegetarian or vegan is traditionally understood as making the desired results more difficult, which are difficult enough to attain as it is. That said, it was not only India that was invaded by Aryans or Indo-Europeans, it was the West as well. Just as the name implies, Indo-European describes a population that extended into the Indus Valley, but also into Europe. There are many different names that this collection of semi-nomadic tribes went by, and while the ancient Indian and Iranians document the term Aryan in their texts and etched into cuneiform stone thousands of years ago, they're also known by other names in their expansions westward along the steppes. I already mentioned the Scythians, which were fierce warriors that established a culture and a region of influence that was prominent between 900 BC and 200 BC, stretching from the Black Sea to China. With stories of waves of inhabitants making it from the east to the west, all the way into Ireland. I'd like to play a short clip now of a Scottish researcher that touches on some of this, whose name I wasn't able to locate, but I'll include a link to the original video source in the description, and then I'll be back to comment on it further.
In the 1320 Declaration of Arbroath, which was a letter signed by almost 50 earls and barons of Scotland and sent to the Pope, asking him to recognise Scotland's independence and Robert the Bruce as king, there is a curious reference to Greater Scythia. The declaration states that the Scots journeyed from Greater Scythia by way of the Tyrrhenian Sea and the Pillars of Hercules, and dwelt for a long course of time in Spain. Thence it came, 1200 years after the people of Israel crossed the Red Sea, to its home in the west, where it still lives today. Yet can we give any credence to this origin story of the Scots? Scythia, or Greater Scythia, after all, referred to a region and the people of a region that was in Central Asia, corresponding to the area around the Black Sea, Ukraine, and the vast lands of southern Russia. Interestingly, the physical appearance of Scythians was reportedly not too dissimilar from the appearance of Scottish or Celtic people. As well as being heavily tattooed, some of the Scythian women reportedly had fair hair and blue eyes, while some of the men had red hair. Certain sources also suggested that some Scythians had white hair, with these people referred to as albini, It is at least interesting to note that Scotland in Gaelic is called Alba. The two main groups that merged and formed the Kingdom of Scotland in 843 AD were the Picts and the Scots, with both of these groups having origin stories that reference Scythia. It's of course important to emphasise here that separating myth and allegory from history is difficult when there are little or no definitive written records about the origins of these people. Regardless, before detailing the possible Scythian connections, it's important to understand a little about the Picts and the Scots. The first thing to note about the Picts is that they left no written records outside of mysterious hieroglyphics carved into stone, so accounts of this people are from other sources. In fact, we don't even know what these people called themselves. It was the Romans who probably gave them the name Picti, meaning painted people. They are thought to be descendants of people who lived in the region that we now call Northern Scotland, with the Romans calling these people Britanni or Caledoni, although these may all be Latin words for essentially the same people or the same groups of people. It is believed that the Picts spoke a Celtic language, but closer to Welsh or Breton rather than Irish or Scottish Gaelic. The Scots, on the other hand, were a Gaelic-speaking people. The Gaels built a Gaelic kingdom in Argyll that had significant influence. Over the decades and centuries, Pictish culture was gradually engulfed by its Gaelic counterpart, perhaps in part due to the power of the Irish Church. The two groups also began to unify more in an attempt to defend against a common enemy that soon raised its head, the Vikings, including an unsuccessful defence against Viking raiders in the 9th century, known as the Disaster of 839. Shortly after this disaster, however, the Kingdom of Scotland, or Alba in Gaelic, is said to have been born in 843 AD, under the leadership of Kenneth MacAlpin, or Kenneth I, the first King of Scots, who unified the Scots and the Picts into one. If we turn our attention back to the origin stories of these two groups, however, an interesting reference to Scythia is present for both groups. An origin story that links the Picts to Scythia comes from the Venerable Bede in his book Historia, published in 731 AD. The story goes that the Picts sailed from Scythia to Ireland, but after the Irish refused to allow them to settle on their land, they were told of another land close by, Scotland. Lacking wives, the Picts then took Irish women with them, under the condition that they would promote their kings from the female royal line as opposed to the male. In relation to the Scots, one of the most popular origin stories is that they are descended from the daughter of an Egyptian pharaoh called Skota. After leaving Egypt, the story goes that Skota and her people lived in Spain for a period, then on to Ireland, and eventually settled in Scotland. Certain stories argue that Skota was married to a Scythian prince who himself was a son-in-law of a pharaoh. There is also another angle that one can view the fact that both the Picts and the Scots have a shared Scythian reference in some of their origin stories. It was in the interest of those who favoured the union of the Picts and the Scots into the Kingdom of Scotland to find or potentially create commonalities between the two peoples who had not always been allies. Scythian connections are not always found in all the origin stories about these two peoples. A separate origin story of the Picts, for instance, argues that they are descended from the Celtic goddess Brigid. In Irish mythology, Brigid was part of an ancient fairy race of supernatural beings. Whether there is any truth to the idea that Scots are descendants of Scythians is hard to say. It is certainly possible that groups of Scythians sailed from towns close to the Black Sea, through the Mediterranean and around the Iberian Arc to settle in the ancient lands of Scotland. Yet, as with all origin stories of all peoples, the question always is, where does myth end and history begin?
I've already covered Princess Skata in a prior video, which was well received with over 1 million views, which I will leave a link to in the description, so I won't cover that again. But I do want to talk about the early genetic makeup of Europe. There were several waves of migration into Europe during the Holocene, and while this is hotly debated at one point, there's no longer any discussion, as advances in genomic studies have come a long way and the DNA evidence is conclusive and irrefutable. In regards to Ireland, there once was a Neolithic population that occupied almost all of Europe, which shared genetic affinities to the ancient Basque, and this includes Ireland. Incidentally, the word Neolithic means stone, as in the tool technology the people used. So, Stone Age. And there was a major wave that came in around 5,000 years ago. Not the first, but substantial in terms of genetic displacement or hybridization, and several subsequent waves that followed. This is why Northern European populations have among the highest degree of lactose tolerance in the world. Normally, adult mammals do not drink milk. It's for babies. However, the population that domesticated the horse and cattle introduced both of these agricultural livestock to Europe, as they did to other parts of the world, as well as their own genetic contribution and adaptation. And I have another short excerpt that I'd like to now play, which will elaborate on this point.
Okay, we are in the middle of the third science revolution in archaeology. It's a revolution on par with the C14 revolution and on par with the revolution of when archaeology was formed. It is a revolution in the sense that a breakthrough within science have created a completely new, open new window to knowledge that was not possible before. We can start now, rather than debating if migration took place as we've been doing over the last 100 years without never ever coming to a conclusion, or then we now know when migration took place, and we can instead, we are intellectually freed to start to ask more interesting questions. How and why? Now we know that by the around 3000 BC, there was a decline all over Northern and Western Europe in the Neolithic settlements. We asked the geneticists to go back and look for diseases, because we said, you know, migrations are not enough to explain how the steppe people could come to dominate completely, also genetically. Something more must be going on. And who were they? Well, what we know now is that they were tall, they were healthy, more healthy than Neolithic people, and they had a different diet based on meat and milk products. And we also see here the first appearance of lactose tolerance. They settled in areas that looked as much as possible as steppe areas. Flat, open lands with forest, light forest that they could easily burn off and create those open steppe-like environments they were used to. And that's exactly what they did in Western Jutland, Northern Germany, in Holland, in Switzerland. They simply burned off the forest and created grasslands. And they created the same kind of long lines of barrows in the landscape to connect the environment exactly as you find it in the steppe. And they brought with them a new burial tradition. Obviously, there would still be a Neolithic population surviving and persisting. And some of these encounters were, as we know very well from Eulau here, could be quite dramatic, and people could be killed. So what we see here is something that must have been the normal situation. New migrants come in, and most of these new migrants we now know were young males or males. So this is a very strongly male-dominated migration in the initial phase. And the initial phase, that's virtually no material culture. We have dated a number of burials, and we know that they are very early. And some of the very early ones, like we have in Poland and South Germany, we have hammerheaded pins of the steppe type. Here we have the early migrants, because the Yam Naya culture had no real pottery tradition. They were mobile. All the material culture was in mats, in woven things, in things they could move and which wouldn't crack up like pottery. So basically, they come with a mobile material culture that leave no traces. And the earliest grave have rarely any pottery. Pottery will only come after some generations when they start to get marry in women. We can see that here we have two of the cemeteries. They have a very protein-rich diet compared to Neolithic groups, which eat a lot more cereals, get a lot of bad teeth. So here we have the new diet that's here. But what we also have here, we have quite a large group of non-locals. And this large group of non-locals was predominantly women. So here we have, Eulau was no accident. It was not a singular event. We can show here that the normal thing in the mature phase of the corded ware culture was to marry in women from other groups outside. And where did they come from? Well, their diet was Neolithic. They have a different diet in their childhood than the male population who are still on meat and milk. And so in that process, over time, you will develop something called pre-proto-Germanic or whatever you call it.
So what he's saying is that there were waves of migrations into Europe, and these Aryan men with horses, bronze medals, and high-protein diets would intermingle with the local Neolithic women. And this is the case in all areas where we have Indo-European languages and swastikas, such as India, Iran, Eurasia, Western China, and Europe, as well as places that do not have Indo-European languages, but have a nobility which share genetic affinities or have a traditional reverence of Caucasians, such as Japan, the Middle East, North Africa, and Southeast Asia. You'll notice how in Thailand, there's a variation in Thai phenotypes, and Buddha is still always depicted with blue eyes there. Which brings us back to the Scythians, who some claim have shared genetic ancestry to Gautama Buddha himself. The horse-riding people of the steppes did seem to hold some similar spiritual philosophies with what is traditionally considered Buddhism. That said, they did eat meat, and in some certain tribes, this included a degree of cannibalism, or at least blood drinking, sometimes from cups made from the skulls of their enemies. But they were very against eating pork. And according to Herodotus, banned pigs from their territory entirely. This dietary practice naturally makes one wonder about the rumors that they were part of the demographic popularly regarded as the Lost Tribes, or Israelites. With that, I have one more short excerpt I'd like to play regarding the Scythian identity.
The Phoenicians had been present as miners and as traders, mining tin in that area for many, many years, even before their alliance with the Israelites. the Tuatha De Danann, or part of the tribe of Dan, obviously, arrived as well in the British Isles, principally in Ireland. When Samaria fell, though, most did not go a journey that far. That would have been a pretty rigorous sea voyage, especially if you're bringing your wives and kids with you. A lot went a shorter distance to Carthage. But evidence exists that most of the Israelites did not go into captivity, nor did they make sea voyages to new lands, but instead migrated via land and conquered a new homeland in the Black Sea region. In 1875, an official of Queen Victoria's British government, Colonel Gawler, wrote a treatise called Our Scythian Ancestors Identified with Israel, citing many classical and medieval sources that most of the 10 tribes migrated north of Armenia and became the Scythians or Sakae of the Greek records by the Black Sea. Ortelius, who was a 16th century geographer for the Spanish king, wrote that when the Israelites migrated into the Caucasus, they took the name Gothi, which the Romans later called Goths. A medieval Jewish writer by the name of Eldad recorded, and I'm going to read his quote in direct quotes here, many Israelites did not go into captivity, but evaded the calamity, going off with their flocks and turning nomads, and that the chief or prince whom they appointed could muster 120,000 horsemen and 100,000 foot soldiers. So with an armed escort of 250,000 men, now if you figure 10,000 for a division, that's quite a few armed divisions going up in terms of armed strength. This mass of Israelites, when you brought your wives and the children with you, the whole mass of people, easily numbered 1 or 2 million, perhaps more. When the Scythians or Sakae were located up in that Black Sea region, of course the Sakae was, again, I just picture the word Isaac, and Sakae is S-A-C-A-E. It has the syllable of Sak, Isaac or Itzhak right in it, fitting that prophecy in Genesis 21:12, that in Isaac will your seed be called, and they carried the name of Isaac with them. Herodotus, the Greek geographer, recorded, of these Scythians, it says that they make no offerings of pigs, nor will they keep them at all in their country. To the extent Scythia is ever discussed in a textbook, which is very likely very little, it probably does not mention that they were pretty much kosher in their approach to the meats. Idols were singularly absent in Scythian relics. Now, the Scythians gave the Israelite names to the rivers that emptied into the Black Sea when they got there. They used to have Greek names like the Ister, the Borysthenes, and I forget Tanae, I think, and I forget the other one. They gave it the names Danube, Dniester, Dnieper, and Don, all of them after the tribe of Dan, right after Israel got there. In about 624 BC, Scythia conquered all of Asia Minor, Mesopotamia. They passed through the area of Palestine, were at the borders of Egypt ready to invade when the Egyptian rulers gave them tribute to let them make them leave them alone. But Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire were effectively given the coup de grace as this. They ravaged the land of Mesopotamia. And you can see the revenge motive here, that Israel, who had been driven off its land, would love to come back and do payback to the Assyrian Empire, which they did. But the Scythians were very protective of the Jews in Judah, didn't harm them at all. In 528 BC, Cyrus the Great of Persia, who I'm sure you've heard about, attacked the Scythians living near the Caspian and Aral Sea. Persia attacked a main tribe of the Sakae called the Massa Gittai, which in my book I identify as Manasseh. Scythia was ruled at that time by a queen. Her name was Tamaris. Obviously, Tamar is one of the Davidic names. David had a daughter, Tamar. That name shows up in Among the Roots of Judah. Now, this Queen Tamaris I discuss in my book was quite an old world version of the Iron Lady, Maggie Thatcher of Britain, who I always had a very high opinion of. But this queen was a tough lady, and when Cyrus the Great attacked, she warned him to stay out and told him he would get his fill of blood if he didn't leave. But they tried to keep the peace. Persia was the aggressor. The Scythians said, why don't you go back to your own place? We'll live in ours, and let's avoid all this bloodshed. Persia would have none of it. So they attacked. Queen Tamaris led her army against the Persians. Cyrus the Great lost his life. He was killed there. Most of his army was destroyed, which the Greeks record of this battle. The Massa Gittai utterly crushed the Persian Empire, and yet you hardly hear about them in any of the history books. We hear about the losers, the Assyrians who lost to the Scythians, the Persians who lost twice to the Scythians again. And King Darius, then of Persia, tried for some revenge in about 512 BC. He led an army, bigger one this time. They had more respect for Scythia now. He led an army of 700,000 over in the Black Sea region of the Scythians. He didn't try to fight those ones on the east anymore. He went over to the west side to see if they were a little softer. Well, they had different tactics, just like the Russians used against Napoleon or against Hitler. They just had scorched earth. They pulled back into the immense, they filled in the wells behind them, gave nothing to the Persians. They extended their supply lines eventually too far, and it became untenable, and they all had to retreat. But the Persians lost 70,000 men in that particular engagement. Now, that's about what the United States lost in 14 years in Vietnam. And Persia lost that just in one campaign, lasting a few months. The one thing I do want to mention about this is the eagle was a common Scythian symbol and a clump of arrows being held in the talon of the eagle. Can you think of a modern country in the world that has its eagle crest with a clump of arrows as its war sign? The United States, which I identify as Manasseh, and that was the Massa Gittai of Scythia, had the same image.
So let us take a look at the demographic that is today collectively known as Jews. The word Jew is associated with monotheism, or the belief in one God, and is one of the 12 tribes called Israelites, as well as Judea, the southern part of the land in the Levant that the Israelites settled after leaving Egypt. First, let me define the word Levant, which, from the vantage point of the civilizations around the Mediterranean Sea, means rising in the context of the sun. So from Rome, Carthage, Egypt, Greece, the sun is rising from the east, the direction of Phoenicia or Israel. So that area was known as the Levant. Manetho, an Egyptian priest of the 3rd century BC, considered the Hyksos as shepherd kings, or captive shepherds, who invaded Egypt from Phoenicia, or the Levant, introducing the horse, chariot, and bronze medals to Africa, before being expelled, which Josephus, a Jewish historian of the 1st century, equates with the Exodus story of the Israelites. So Josephus equates them with the Jews, but he also calls them Arabs. So these were Semitic people, which doesn't indicate a specific race, but a language group. And the word Semitic comes from Sem, one of the three sons of Noah. This dynasty of people eventually settled in Israel, and I use that term because an Egyptian pharaoh used it 3,200 years ago, etched in stone on a giant stele currently housed in the Egyptian Museum. They had a civil war between the two southern tribes, one of which was Judea, and the 10 northern tribes, and other nations got involved, taking sides, and some of the Judeans were taken into captivity by the Babylonians, but not all, and the northern tribes were dispersed shortly after by the Assyrians. Some took to the Mediterranean, and others went north. The theory that the Scythians were part of the dispersed Israelite tribe is supported by the fact that in northern Israel, there's an ancient city known as Scythopolis, or City of the Scythians. The history goes back into the Bronze Age, and I guess it was burned down during the Assyrian invasions that forced inhabitants to leave northward. A stone stele found there depicts a lion and a dog, and I'll come back to that later if there's time. When we look at the demographic that controlled the Silk Road, we see a blonde, Yiddish-speaking people that today are called Ashkenazi Jews. Yiddish is a hybrid language, partially High German, partially Hebrew, and likely came about so that they could maintain a sort of monopoly on trade. There are villages in Anatolia, or modern Turkey, called Ashkenaz, and that word comes from one of the descendants of Noah, but not Sem, where we get Semitic, but Japheth, another son who all Aryans are said to descend from. In rabbinic literature, the kingdom of Ashkenaz was first associated with the Scythian region, then later with the Slavic territories, and from the 11th century onwards with Germany and Northern Europe. When we look into Ashkenazi DNA, such as on this website of the U.S. National Library of Medicine and National Institute of Health, Frontiers of Genetics, in an article titled The Origins of Ashkenaz, Ashkenazic Jews, and Yiddish, we read that, quote, uncertainties concerning the meaning of Ashkenaz arose in the 11th century when the term shifted from a designation of the Iranian Scythians to become that of Slavs and Germans, and finally of German Ashkenazic Jews in the 11th to 13th centuries. The site goes on to say that, quote, the term Ashkenaz, originally affiliated with the people living north of biblical Israel, used in Hebrew and Yiddish sources from the 11th century onward to denote a region in what is now roughly southern Germany. Southern Germany, incidentally, is where Swabia is located, where we get the term Neuschwabenland from, if you've watched some of my other videos. The study also offers a couple of hypotheses stating that they were, quote, an Iranian people near Armenia, presumably Scythians, known as Askuza, Asguza, or Iskuza in Assyrian inscriptions of the early 7th century BC. Geographical population structure, or GPS, which localizes genomes to where they experienced the last major admixture event, uncovered 4 primeval villages in northeastern Turkey whose name resemble Ashkenaz. Ashkenazi Jews exhibit high genetic similarity to populations living in Turkey and the Caucasus. All biolocation analysis predicted Ashkenazi Jews to Turkey. Ashkenazic Jews were predicted to a Near Eastern hub of ancient trade routes that connected Europe, Asia, and the Northern Caucasus. The findings imply that migration to Europe took place initially through trade routes going west and later through Khazar lands. Ancient DNA analysis provides strong evidence of the Iranian Neolithic ancestry of Ashkenazi Jews. Ashkenazi Jews were speculated to have absorbed Slavic people, developed Slavic Yiddish, and intensified the migration to Europe. So let's keep in mind that in an ancient context, when you hear the word Iranian, especially Neolithic period, that means blonde-haired, blue-eyed people. This is established by genetics, with numerous published studies that you can look up, or by the ancient Iranian mummies along the Silk Road that are 4,000 years old and come from Iran, not Europe, but Iran, prior to entering Europe, and are over 6 feet tall and blonde.
It is important through genetics to figure out where people came from because they don't look like they belong. That is a funny way of saying it, because they were there, they lived there, and they did belong. But we have, as modern human beings, a preconceived notion about how the world should look like. Well, the mummies from China don't look like they should be in China. They look like they should be in Denmark or Ireland or northern Germany, because they look like people from over there. So what are these guys doing so many hundreds, thousands of miles to the east? DNA steps up to the plate, and they can tell us where they came from. The males came from parts further west. Not necessarily Ireland, but places like Iran, maybe towards parts of Turkey. And that's the wonderful thing about DNA testing.
If one looks at ancient Phoenician symbols around the world, such as these from Sumer and Ethiopia, and compares them to those used by Germanic Teutonic Knights, or the Order of the German House of St. Mary in Jerusalem, or even the Knights Templar, that were involved in the European Crusades that retook Jerusalem, and the symbols used by certain European nationalist parties in Europe in the 30s, then a picture should start to develop. That said, the Israelites did not just go north. They went into the Mediterranean and across the Atlantic into the Americas. The modern tribes known as Native Americans were not the only inhabitants here. They're just the most recent and the only ones we're allowed to know about.
The name Carthage comes from Roman sources. Carthage never called themselves that. If they could be resurrected now and we said, oh, you're Carthaginians, they'd say, who? Carthage grew strong and rich. They had such a powerful navy that for centuries they forbid the Greeks and Romans to even go out into the Atlantic. That was their private playground and their private domain, because they exploited the Atlantic world for their own wealth. And Carthage was known as an incredibly wealthy city. Carthage had Gibraltar, or as they called it, the Pillars of Hercules. That's one of the gates of their enemies. Frederick Pohl's book, Atlantic Crossings Before Columbus, quotes two Greek accounts of Carthage's secret Atlantic land. So they learned about it, they just couldn't go see it. One is a fairly respected source, Aristotle. He states, in the sea outside the Pillars of Hercules, the Carthaginians found a wilderness with navigable rivers. Carthage, the master of the Western Ocean, which meant the Atlantic, observed that many people attracted by the fertile soil and pleasant climate resided there. Carthage decreed no one else under penalty of death would be allowed to sail there. They kept the land secret. Another Greek writer wrote, "There lies a very great island in the vast ocean, many days' sail westward from Africa. The soil is fruitful, a great part of it is mountainous, but there's a large plain watered with several navigable rivers, you know, the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Ohio, etc. The mountainous part is clothed with very large woods." Well, obviously, this is North America. And the Greek histories also record that the Carthaginians sent fleets with tens of thousands of settlers out through the Pillars of Hercules. They assumed they were going to colonies in Africa or Europe, but frankly, there isn't a population base there to indicate that that is where they went. And now, through the work of Barry Fell and the Epigraphic Society, we know a lot of those colonists came to our side of the Atlantic. Carthaginian coins, writings, and artifacts have been found in Colorado, New York, Alabama, Georgia, Connecticut, Nevada, and other places. But why is this fact, why are these facts not in textbooks? Well, obviously it's being suppressed. We're in a Darwinian evolutionary society. They don't want anything out there that supports the Bible or gives credibility to it. They want to defend their God, natural selection. But the fact is, the Phoenicians and Carthaginians sailed the oceans for centuries. They knew the world was round about a millennium before the Greeks learned it. So we have this myth that the Greeks were the founders of all civilization, when in fact the Phoenicians and Carthaginians would be just absolutely amazed if they could be resurrected now and see that their ancient propaganda was being taught as facts, because the Greeks got this world is flat notion from a disinformation campaign from the Phoenicians and Carthaginians. They knew the wealth that was out on the other side of the Atlantic and other places. They wanted to scare everybody else away. So they invented those maps you see in the ancient world where it shows these monstrous sea creatures that would just gobble ships, you know. So the Carthaginians invented that to scare their enemies off the ocean so they could have a monopoly. And they understood latitude and longitude. They knew how to navigate with the trade winds and the currents back and forth across the oceans with no difficulty. But the Greeks, for example, were so ignorant of this that at one point the Carthaginian navy, which usually blocked the Pillars of Hercules, was gone on a war. A Greek sailor from Marseille, France, named Pythias, sailed through the Pillars of Hercules and started going north in the direction of Britain. He was absolutely amazed to see that the constellations changed position in the sky further north he went. He went back and told the Greek world, "The earth must be round. The positions of the stars is changing. It's like I'm sailing on a sphere going," you know. They all laughed him to scorn and said, "No, of course you know it's flat." And so that's where our great Greek civilization also was deceived by the Carthaginians. Well, Carthage did have an entire civilization here. Historians discuss two mysterious civilizations in ancient America, the Adena people, who inhabited the Ohio River Valley. They can identify from about 1000 B.C., onward. Now that's the time of King David and Solomon, when they were sending fleets across the ocean until they merged with the Hopewell people around 300 to 200 BC. They died out centuries later, but 300 to 200 BC is a key time as well. That's the time of the Punic Wars, when the Carthaginians were losing to the Romans and more of their people left for their colonial system as refugees. Presidents Jefferson and Harrison, well, about the mound builders, they were wondering if these weren't built by the lost tribes of Israel. And one of the artifacts in an Adena grave was translated by Barry Fell as Punic in the form of an alphabet used in Iberia, that was in Carthage's territory, in the first millennium B.C. It was a language of Carthage, which was from the Hebrew. So as soon as they found out that, oh, there's Semitic goods in these mounds, we don't want to dig up anymore, You know, the establishment didn't want to find out anything more there. There were Semitic names and grave goods. They even had copper hides. Those of you who, you know, it was a form of ancient currency. It was a copper that looked like a rectangle with hooks on it. And they've even dug those up in American sites.
Situated on the Vltava River, Prague's population is estimated at over 2 million people and once was the main residence of several Holy Roman emperors. It was an important city to the Habsburg monarchy and its Austro-Hungarian Empire, playing major roles in the Protestant Reformation and the Thirty Years' War, which I've covered in a previous video and have included a link to in the description for those who may have missed it and are interested. Built in the 9th century, the Prague Castle is the official office of the President of the Czech Republic and was a seat of power for kings of Bohemia, emperors, and the presidents of Czechoslovakia. The castle houses several museums, and the city itself has a rich history that extends well into antiquity. The region was settled as early as the Paleolithic Age, which means Stone Age, but in relatively more recent times was founded by an ancient king named Boya in 1306 BC, and the city was named Bohaim. Around the 5th century BC, a Celtic tribe appeared in the area, establishing settlements and naming the region of Bohemia, meaning home of the boy people. The etymology of the word belongs to the Indo-European or Aryan family with two major derivations, meaning either cow or warrior. So boy would either be the herding people or the warrior people. In any event, they were eventually driven away a few centuries later by several Germanic tribes, such as the Marcomanni, the Quadi, and the Lombards, who later went on to rule most of the Italian peninsula from 568 to 774. That said, Roman-era authors reported the Lombards as one of the Suebian people, and according to Tacitus and Strabo, the Marcomanni and Quadi were also both Suebian. So besides being Germanic tribes, who exactly are the Suebian people? On this map of some of the tribes in Germania during the Roman Empire, the Suebi are in magenta, and we can see them occupying the north, where Sweden is, which is where the Swedes get their name from, the same root, and we also see them coming in from the east. The etymology of the word means one's own tribesmen, kinsmen, or one's own people. So we have the Swedes, which incidentally is interesting to compare this map of the early Swedes to this map showing the distribution of light or blonde hair in Europe. It is equally as interesting to compare it to this map showing the percentage of light eyes or blue eyes in Europe. I think the visual comparison here speaks for itself. According to early sources, such as the Icelandic sagas, the Swedes were a powerful tribe whose kings claimed descendants from the god Freyr. During the Viking Age, they constituted the basis of the subset known as the Rus people, where we get the word Russian from. Rus means red, also associated with Slavic tribes, which Arabian historian Al-Masti from the 10th century claims was due to their sunburnt faces, which is a nice guess and a nice try, but I'll have to offer other interpretations on that a little later. Back to the fertility and wisdom god Freyr, who in the mythological stories in Icelandic books, the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, is presented as one of the Vanir and Aesir. In Germanic religion and mythology, the gods are roughly divided into two tribes, the Vanir and Aesir, who are rivals, but Freyr is considered part of both. In Norse mythology, these two groups of deities had a conflict, and the war ultimately ended, resulting in a unification into a single pantheon. Incidentally, Freyr has a sister named Freya, who cries tears of red gold. The Roman historian Tacitus writes in his first century book called Germania about her veneration as what he deems as an Isis of the Suebi, referring to the Egyptian goddess and associating her to a group of Germanic people. More on that a little later. Besides Sweden, they occupied much of the territory around the Elbe River, one of the major rivers of Central Europe, traversing much of the western half of the Czech Republic, then Germany, and flowing into the North Sea, just northwest of Hamburg, but also running near Berlin, Dresden, Leipzig, and of course Prague. In 406 AD, Suebian tribes led by Hermeric, a pagan and an enemy of the Roman Empire throughout his life, led the Suevi along with the Vandals and Alans, establishing the Kingdom of Suebi, one of the first to separate from the Roman Empire. It maintained its independence until 585, when it was annexed by the Visigoths. Here's an image from the Encyclopedia Britannica, and the caption reads, Alani invading Gaul, Alani with the Germanic Vandals and Suebi invading Gaul, which is modern-day France. Here's a page in Wikipedia about the Alani, or Alans, and it reads, the name Alan is an Iranian dialectical form of Aryan. Here's an image that they used to illustrate their migration path, originating from the area around the Black Sea and penetrating into Europe. They fought side by side with the Suebi, who were also Indo-European or Indo-Iranian, both stemming from the same ethnic Aryans, who are also linked to the Scythians, the most common name for the Indo-European tribes living around the Black Sea and Eurasian steppes. The Scythians were considered ancient Iranians, were masters of mounted warfare, especially with a spear, and were ethnically of the phenotype consisting predominantly of blonde or red hair and blue eyes. The term German, which are composed of many tribes but one great ethnic group, literally translates to spearmen. Gar means spear, as a spear was the most common of weapons in ancient Germanic society, and every free man had at least one. The name German was once only belonging to one single tribe, and later became applied to the entirety of the people of the same ethnic or genetic or racial stock residing in Northern Europe. A distinctive cultural trait among the elite of the Germanic tribes was wearing a Suebian knot. The Suebian knot was a hairstyle where long hair was tied in a knot along the side of the head. Suebi of higher status, such as chieftains, would have more elaborate knots than the Suebi of lower status. The Suebian knot was also considered the mark of a free man. It is interesting to note the similarity in hairstyle with ancient Egyptian nobility and pharaohs, called the Horus lock, or Prince's lock, or side braid. It was also known as the side lock of youth, a marker of Egyptian aristocracy and priesthood, connected with the Egyptian mystery religion that was introduced into other countries through the ancient Israelite migrations, particularly connected with the tribe of Dan, amongst other Israelite tribes, as well as the Phoenicians, who are also a branch of Israelites. The word Phoenician is from the Greek word phoinos, meaning blood red. Each of the 12 tribes had a color, and the color attributed to the tribe of Dan is red. It's a color also associated with a certain banking family who goes by the name meaning red shield. Of course, earlier I told you that Rus means red, linked to the Swedish kings and to the Vikings, such as Eric the Red, another topic I covered in a video, and we'll leave a link in the description. The flag of the Soviet Union was red, and the hammer and sickle in occult terms represents male and female, as the sickle, traditionally a symbol of agriculture, was historically tied to the female, and the hammer, having to do with blacksmithing, was male. Of course, Thor also has a hammer, a thunder god imported into Europe from Eurasia, as Europe itself is named after a Phoenician princess, Europa. That said, the Scythians were experts with metal, particularly gold, and I've already done several videos linking the Scythians with one of the lost tribes, and according to Herodotus, the Scythians had a taboo against the pig, which was totally banned within their land. So while the hammer and sickle is a symbolic joining of the male and female, at least in the occult world, the same can be said for the Seal of Solomon, which is also the joining of two opposing triangles, which in an alchemical context represents male and female, fundamental to all occult philosophy. I've also covered in several videos the fact that the Star of David or Seal of Solomon is oftentimes found historically side by side with the swastika, whether in Phoenician territory such as Cyprus, or left by the Knights Templar in places like Lalibela, Ethiopia, carved into the rock, or in this interesting image from India, where if you look close, each eye of the skull has a symbol in it. I also covered skull symbology in a recent video as well. Which brings us back to Germany, particularly in the 30s and 40s, where the Nationalist Socialist Party's flag not only had the swastika symbol, used by the Phoenicians, Scythians, Vikings, Templars, and Aryans in general, but also was red. In southern Germany, we have a Suebian territory which today is called Swabia, a familiar-sounding name to those familiar with Operation High Jump, a still-classified mission when, in 1946, following the alleged end of World War II, the Allies sent 3 aircraft carriers with over 4,000 armed men to invade Antarctica, where the Germans had annexed and renamed the portion of the continent as Neuschwabenland, or New Swabia, and built military bases and a colony under the ice, reachable only by U-boat, of which the Germans had larger and more sophisticated models not yet disclosed to the public. While the details concerning Operation High Jump remain murky, what is known is that the Allies suffered a military defeat, and decades of speculation has followed concerning a breakaway German civilization that never surrendered, but instead not only survives until this day, aided by their advanced technology, but still covertly wields some political influence on the planet and has continued fighting a war that officially ended, but whose struggle continues behind the scenes. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.